Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Steve Farnsworth from the Perry Hall Speakers Group.
Hi, everybody. I'm Steve Farnsworth from Alcoholic. And like you said, my home group is Perry Hall Speakers Group. It's a Tuesday night, 1 hour speaker meeting, a lot like this one, only we don't meet outdoors. And it's 8:30. Perry Hall is kind of a section of Baltimore, on the north side of Baltimore, out there, pretty close to 95 and the Beltway, just outside the Beltway. Anyways, it's an enthusiastic group, and I really want to make sure that if I do nothing else, I extend the invitation to come join us if you're in the area. We'd love to have you. And my sobriety date is June 18th, 1989. And so if I don't have a spiritual blackout and pick up a substance that AA requires me to pick up a white chip over in the next couple of weeks, I guess I'll have 21 years here in a few weeks. But I intentionally said the spiritual blackout combined with picking up some substance that AA requires you to start your sobriety time over with. AA really doesn't have that requirement, but it's kind of like an unspoken requirement, I guess. It's really personal, but I promise you that if I had to pick up a white chip every time I had a spiritual blackout, I'd be getting one right now. I pretty much had one as I was walking from the car. But I have a real simple job to do here today, and that is basically to take my turn at sharing, you know, my perception of my experience, what it used to be like, how I got here, what it's been like since. And it's only my perception. You know, there's probably a lot of people that would be much better witnesses to my experience than I am. You know, there's one thing that is available to every single man, woman, and child on this planet, but will never be available to me. And that is a clear, objective perspective of my life. You know, because my perspective of my life is going to always, as long as I'm alive, be clouded by my plans, designs, and desires. And it's just that simple. And I think that's why good sponsorship is necessary, good friends are necessary, and a constant and continual examination of my experience using principles, so that I can maybe see exactly what happened, not necessarily because I need that knowledge to be smart, but hopefully so that I don't have to repeat things that I don't really want to repeat. You know, if you go down to Washington, D.C., on the in front of the Museum of Natural History, engraved in stone, it says, "Men who forget their past are doomed to repeat it." And, you know, there's nothing wrong with having shortcomings. There's nothing wrong with stumbles and mistakes. The problem is when I keep making the same mistakes over and over again, and I don't learn and grow from them. And that's what I believe one of the things that steps 3 through 10 do for me is they allow me to, you know, recognize that and examine my mistakes and my stumbles, so that I can be a little bit more informed the next time I'm faced with should I or shouldn't I, you know. And because sanity is, you know, they talk about sanity being defined as doing or not doing the same things over and over again, expecting different results. But there's times where I've done the same things over and over again and knew exactly what the results were going to be, and I, you know, but I was okay with that, you know, and I paid those prices. Nothing's without prices. So, anyways, I got sober in June of 1989. I should have gotten sober when I was probably around 15 or 16 years old, but I was 28, and but I promise you that I actually have a friend, the guy that I sponsor, who's here with me right now, that got sober when he was 16, and he's been sober now, 13, 14 years? And I had somebody last night, Ante, he asked me, because I can't imagine getting sober at 16, And my reaction to that statement was that I was searching at 16 years old. I was searching hard. You know, if I had been fortunate enough at the right time when I was searching to have stumbled across people like you who were willing to extend a loving, compassionate, understanding, patient hand. I would have followed you to the ends of the earth at 16 years old, and I would have turned away from that drink. I know I would have, because my sponsor Tom, he says, you know, if you want to get a bone away from a dog, you need to offer him a steak. You know, and he will not be concerned with the bone. And if you had come to me when I was 16 years old and offered me something equivalent, you know, to a steak, I would have turned away from the drink and the other substances, because I wasn't stupid. You know, I always like to throw out the disclaimer that I'm not too sure that stupid people know they're stupid, but I don't think I'm stupid. And I could see the trouble that I was getting into, and I could see the and I could hear, you know, the words from the police and the words that were written on the citations and the words that were coming from my parents and my teachers and other people that cared about me. You know, the common denominator was the drink and the other substances. So but the problem was is you weren't offering me a sufficient replacement. You know, you take away the only hope that I have and not offer a sufficient replacement. You know, I think I'd rather just take this to the bitter end. You know, is the way I see it. That's another way of saying that I'm not a problem drinker. You know, my sponsor says that, he goes, you know, I'm an answer drinker. I'm a solution drinker. You know, my problem was me and the way I saw things and the way I felt. And my solution was to drink in all of its forms, human powers. And they worked. And they came with price tags that I was willing to pay, because because the alternative was not acceptable. But in June of 1989, I had somewhat of a high-profile job. I was flying airplanes for the United States Navy. And one of my drinking buddies was the squadron's flight surgeon. You know? And one of his responsibilities is to watch out for guys like me. And to give you an idea how oblivious I was to drinking being my problem, you know, if I knew drinking was my problem, he'd be the last person in the squadron I'd be drinking with. You know, and you know, I had quite a few incidents. I had an incident about a year prior to that, prior to getting sober, that nobody knew about. But I knew about it. There was a meeting on the base at 12 o'clock noon on a work day. And at that time I was, you know, 27 years old. I was fully indoctrinated into the military, so I, you know, had the look, I had the attitude, I had the haircut, and you know, and it's a work day, and to give you an idea how delusional I was, I brought civilian clothes to go to this meeting at the chapel on the base at noon, because I didn't want anybody to know that I was in the military. And I had me fooled and nobody else. But anyways, but I went into this meeting. And I sat down, and of course I didn't say hi to anybody, because I just didn't really want to talk to anybody. I was not excited about the fact that I might be sitting in an AA meeting. But there was a woman that was secretary in the meeting, and you know, and I knew that she was the president of AA, at least for the state of Maine, possibly for the whole country. And I knew that the basket that we passed was for travel expenses, right? And you know, and I didn't have to ask anybody any questions, because I already had all the answers. You know, and when you already have all the answers, there's no sense in asking questions, right? Now, the answers that I had were completely, you know, delusional, obviously, but it was my delusion, you know. And you know, I've learned over the years that the thing about a delusion is I don't know a minute when I'm in it. You know, it's really real to me. And I've also been around long enough to know that this whole group can be in 100% complete agreement and be sharing the same delusion. I totally respect other people's delusions, and because one day it might be mine. But anyways, I looked at the steps on the wall, and I had those things covered. I agreed with all of them, so therefore I didn't need to ask anybody about that because I already had that done. And so, no surprise, I left that meeting and never came back, and I drank for about another year. I drink consistently. I don't drink sporadically. It's more like a lifestyle for me. Back at least at that point in time it was. And a year later, when they told me that, what had happened was we had this exercise that I was in charge of, and the drill was that you had to stay sober for 24 hours, which is not difficult for me. I can stay sober for 24 hours as long as I know I'm going to get to be able to drink in 24 hours. You tell me I got to stay sober forever, that's a different story. You stay sober for 24 hours, and if the call comes in, you have 1 hour to get to the base, get this nuclear weapon. It was a nuclear weapons training exercise. It wasn't a real nuclear weapon. It was a dud. But get this thing inspected, loaded on the airplane, all the paperwork submitted, all the crew on board, get the engines running at the end of the runway ready to go deliver this weapon within 1 hour. And Sears was delivering my refrigerator at the time when the call came in. And I really wanted my refrigerator. I've been waiting for it for a long time. I don't know if you guys, I was a major beer drinker. I would drink pretty much anything, but I was beer was my like maintenance drink. And I like beer cold, So I was really not enjoying not having a refrigerator, And so anyways, I get this, Sears is like, I'm like, oh, just bring it in, go ahead and leave, I'll put it together. I'll get it all hooked up, whatever, just get out because I got to get going. So basically what ended up happening is I was 20 minutes late, or 15 minutes late, I think it was, for this exercise. And in my mind, I'm like, I can do in 45 minutes what the average guy would take an hour to do, right, in all my humility. And the honest to God's truth is I had that thing, I had everything done within that 1 hour. Even though I was 15 minutes late. And I was impressed. However, my commanding officer and his gurus were not too impressed. All they could see is I was 15 minutes late. And that's what had their attention. And very unreasonable people. they can't see what I can see. And that was like the final straw. There was lots of things before that, lost jobs, screwed up relationships, of every kind, and some really, things that really looked like good ideas, and then I'd execute them, and then I'd see the faces of the people around me, and I'm like, this probably wasn't really a good idea, was it? I borrowed an airplane one time. It really looked like a good idea. And I had it all figured out. Even had the meter disconnected to where they couldn't know that it was gone. That there was. And when I got back, it was obviously not a good idea. They saw a Grand Theft Airplane. I was borrowing it. But that's just an example of my good ideas. So this nuclear weapons training exercise that I fumbled up was kind of the last straw. And I was before board once again. I'd been through before boards before. And I know the drill. And I don't know how many of you have been in the military, but for those of you that are, happy Memorial Day. Is that good Memorial Day? It's not really supposed to be happy, I guess. But Anyways, you get my drift. Anyways, but for those of you in the military, you know, they put a board together, and you got, you know, the good guy, you got the bad guy, you got the administrative guy, and then you got your boss, you know. And I'm standing at attention, and I'm looking at these guys, and in my head, I'm going, what? This is so stupid. We're not at war. It's not a real bomb. You guys are taking this thing way too serious. You know, I'm looking at these guys, I'm like, you know, you were drinking the same way I was last night. I don't know why you're on the board. I saw who you were drinking with last night. I'm sure your wife back in the States would love to hear about that. I'm looking at this guy, I'm like, nobody wants to drink with you anyway, so I don't know why you're here. You know, quickly, you know, brought to a state of realization that I'm the only one standing at attention, and that I better not say that stuff out loud. You know? There's a lot of stuff that goes to my head, followed by a statement to myself. I have conversations with myself. Sometimes I don't even want to get a word in, but I have conversations with myself. And, you know, followed by a statement that says, it's probably a good idea for you to keep this one to yourself, Steve. You know? Anyways, I did what they did. I did the song and dance. They told me to stay sober for a week. And then if you stay sober for a week, you can start flying again. And the translation I got was lock myself up in my room and drink like I want to drink for a week. And come out and tell them I've been sober for a week. And then I can get to fly again. And that's exactly what happened. Well, military intelligence. And so, and that was all fine and good until the nuclear weapons thing. And then that was when I got back home. And that was when they said, okay, you're going to go to rehab. And the way they did that was, there was this guy called the Command Alcohol Abuse Counselor. And he, who's a Master Chief, you know, technically I outranked him, but the guy's been in the military for like 30 years and I was in for like 2 seconds. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, technicalities go out the window. I'm listening to this guy, right? And I expected him to do with me what everybody else was doing, which is point the finger in my face and say, you're screwed up, you're a mess, you need to pull it together, can't you see what you're doing to yourself, da 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 da, you know, Charlie Brown's teacher. And he didn't do that. Fortunately for me, this man was an active member of Al-Anon. And he invited me into his office, he handed me a cup of coffee, he sat me down, he treated me like a man. He talked to me with respect and dignity. He shared with me in a general way what it used to be like for him and how he got here and what it's been like since. And I would have done anything that man told me to do at that point in time. He had my trust. And he told me that I needed to go to 6-week inpatient rehab. And I said, well, you know, I already know about AA. I went to that meeting a year ago. You know, so can I kind of do those classes? You know, and he's like, no, I think you need to go to the inpatient thing. So I'm like, all right. So I go down there, and I'm down in Jacksonville, Florida, and I'm going to rehab. And I had a little bit of a mild case of DTs, which I never really experienced before. I didn't even realize it was what I didn't even realize it was DTs until far, far, you know, in the future when I look back at it. I just thought it was the reason I drank, you know, because I was just like afraid that everybody was going to find out that I was like nothing, complete phony, whatever, you know. And I just thought that's why I was shaking. Yeah. But I told a bunch of stories to the intake counselor. And then within about 3 or 4 days of being in this rehab, you know, kind of, you know, bumping into this guy, I start realizing that these are stories that I've been telling so much that I believed them, and they were complete fabricated stories, or at the very least, exaggerated. And, it, you know, I was, in other words, I started realizing I was believing my own lies. And I started, you know, realizing that my thinking is really not reliable. And, I had a long history when I was in high school of going on trips without leaving my bedroom. I mean, so much to where I had flashbacks for like 10 years. And just for the record, I loved the flashbacks. But anyways, I digress. I know what it's like to go on trips, but I don't like going on trips that I don't sign up for. And what I realized was the drink was taking me on a trip that I did not sign up for. I thought that I had this thing under control. I thought the drink was enhancing my ability to think constructively and calculate and negotiate and whatever and live life. I didn't realize that it was taking me on a delusion that I didn't want to be on. And so I adopted this idea that there were people on this planet that could drink safely, and I was just not one of them, and I was okay with that. And I just kind of pictured Skull and Crossbones on the drink in my mind. And so, you know, I'd have the thoughts go through my head, but I wouldn't romance them, you know. And what I'm really telling you is that I got stopped drinking long before I ever would have figured it out on my own. And what happened was I bought into a delusion, another delusion. And that delusion is that drinking was my problem. And I believe that that's what the people at the rehab are telling me. But I've also been around long enough to know that what people tell me and what I hear are often two different things. I hear what I want to hear, you know. But what I heard was that if I just didn't drink, I'd be okay. And if you just go to these meetings, then somehow you will be magically, you know, removed from the compulsion to drink against your will, you know. And I didn't have a problem with the God stuff that they were talking about. I was very fortunate when I went to college in Oklahoma, and it's kind of like the Southern Baptist Bible Belt, and there was some ladies from the Baptist church, the local Baptist church, that would bribe us with $1 home cooked meals, you know. And I was kind of like a peanut butter and jelly kind of guy, you know. So home cooked meals were really, really attractive. And I would go to this evening service, and I remember hearing a young minister, preacher, or whatever Baptist people have leading the sermon. I can't remember what he looked like, I can't remember what he said, but I remember how I felt when I left. And I remember feeling that way when I was a little kid coming out of church, and my mom would maybe go to church, and I had a little spiritual experience as a kid, and it brought that back. And I was open to the idea that there may be something that's beyond human intellectual understanding. And it's supposed to be that way. It's supposed to be beyond human intellectual understanding. I accepted that in my own heart. And that, you know, that if there really is a creator and a director of everything, obviously he created and directed us. And therefore, if he really wanted us to know intellectually what he was, we would know, since he created us. So the fact that he didn't was by design. That was how I had that calculated, and I still believe that today. That God only proves himself to us in our hearts, not in our heads. And that's just for me. I'm not telling you what to believe. But, so I had this... I had an open mind about the God stuff, and as a matter of fact, I was actually kind of relieved that there was a God presence in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I really felt that it was going to take something that big, because I had already run out of, you know, I tried pretty much everything on the human plane, everything physical and mental. You know, I was married to an absolutely beautiful woman who to be honest with you, I'm still in love with today. Even though it took me 18 years to make amends to her because she wouldn't speak to me. But that was an interesting experience that happened last summer. I thought I had terrorized this woman's life, you know. And when I was making my amends to her, finally she goes, "Steve, I have no idea what you're talking about." She goes, "I remember you being nothing but patient and loving and compassionate with me. We just never should have been married." Wow, it's a good thing I beat myself up for 18 years. but you know, the reason why she didn't contact me is because she had a new husband, and she didn't want to disrespect her new husband. Imagine that. I thought it was all about me. First time. Anyways, so I was okay with all the God stuff, but I came out of that rehab thinking that if I just shouldn't drink and went to meetings and prayed, I'd be okay. And I was okay with the prayer. Drinking, going to a meeting, or not drinking and going to the meetings was, the only thing I felt like I needed to focus on, and then I could go back to managing my own life. I didn't say that because it's up on the wall. It says you can't manage your own life, and I didn't want to contradict what was on the wall. So instead, I would say things like, I need to put balance in my life. Right? Or, I didn't get sober just to go to meetings. You know, translation is I'm going to manage my own life. Right? And I didn't get sober just to go to meetings either, by the way, just for the record. But I did need a sufficient replacement, and I didn't know that. And what I found was the sufficient replacement was being my brother's keeper. The one alcoholic sharing with another. Laying down my life for my brother. Now, laying down my life for my brother does not mean take a bullet. You can only do that once. It means stopping my busy schedule long enough to tell my brother and my sister the good news, and that there is a power that is bigger than human that you can tap into that will solve your problems. And the meetings are where I find people to do that with. But the meetings are not the solution. If you're here thinking the meetings are the solution, that'll work for you as long as you are a problem drinker calling yourself an alcoholic. But if you are what the big book refers to as a real alcoholic, which is somebody who has a spiritual malady, in my opinion, and all you're doing is going to meetings, your life will probably get worse just going to meetings than it ever was when you were drinking. Now, I don't like the term real alcoholic. The only reason I use that is because it's what it says in the big book. Because, you know, I feel like when I'm saying that, I'm a better alcoholic than you, which is really kind of twisted that that's something I would brag about. But if you look up the term, it says, you know, the word comes from a spiritus, you know, which is no surprise because you see wines and spirits on the sides of liquor stores. And prior to the turn of the century of 1800s to 1900s, they didn't refer to the beverage as alcohol. They referred to it as malts, ales, and lagers. But they referred to alcoholism as a spiritual condition as far back as the Bible. And probably further back. Alcoholism is a spiritual condition. That means that by the way I'm using the definition, or the way I'm defining the word, is that you can be alcoholic even if you've never picked up a drink before in your life. I took my niece through these 12 steps when she was 9 years old. And with the exception of the sex conduct list, thank God, it was right. She understood exactly what was going on. You know, and the beautiful part about that is when she was 17 years old, about a year and a half ago, and she had some confusion and questions in that area, she came to her Uncle Steve to talk about that kind of stuff because she knew she was going to get a straight answer without having to divulge the details that I really didn't want to hear anyways. You know? And so it's a beautiful thing. But when I first, like I said, when I first got out of rehab and I started going to meetings thinking that if I just didn't drink and go to meetings that I'd be okay, I didn't realize that only works for problem drinkers who are calling themselves alcoholics. And I'm not a problem drinker. I'm a solution drinker. Life is my problem. The drink is my solution. You took my solution away, whoever you are. And I wasn't getting handed a sufficient replacement. Now, I don't know if there was anybody in the meetings I was going to that were talking about the importance of one alcoholic sharing with another. But I can guarantee you this, I didn't hear it. And I've been back to those meetings since, and I wasn't here. I still wasn't hearing it. So I think it was a little bit of them and a little bit of me. But there's a lot of meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous where they're not talking about God and helping others. Very few where they focus on that. And if you stumbled across a set of people who are mainly attending those kinds of meetings, the kind of meetings where they're talking about God and helping others, consider yourself extremely fortunate. Because in my experience, most meetings aren't doing that. I'm not here to criticize Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. I'm just trying to say that for whatever reason, there's not enough people standing up for God and helping others in AA, in my opinion. And I do a lot of traveling. So anyways, so what ended up happening was I started looking for solutions in other areas. I started looking for solutions in therapy, psychiatry, medications, every self-help book you can imagine. Of course, I had a bookshelf full of them, but I couldn't read them because I can't. I read two paragraphs, and I can't tell you what I just read because I got the committee meetings that don't let me get a word in. You know, but you know, somehow I guess I buy the self-help book, and oh my God, the terror that I would have going up to the counter to pay for one of those books sometimes is just, you know, consuming. But then I just put it on my shelf and never read it, you know. And my sponsor, Tom, he says, you know, I had a whole bookshelf full of self-help books and I stayed drunk. I got one Help Others book and I got sober. So I was about a year and a half sober, and the Navy had about enough of my shenanigans. They were tired of me not getting back to work and getting my act together. They feel like they went above and beyond the call of duty for me already, and they had. And so they discharged me honorably, but involuntarily. And they gave me a big severance check. And I was very happy for a minute. And now I had, by this point I had been divorced. I had gone through I was preparing to go through a bankruptcy and a foreclosure. And I had a car that was not worth the towing charges, but reliable because it had a good engine in it. And I had a physical body that was, you know, not this body, but that one, and that could turn ahead way back when. I could walk into a room and get some attention. As long as I didn't open my mouth, I was probably pretty attractive. And so my solution to my, you know, my marriage problems and my financial problems and my unemployment problems and my, you know, whatever, every problem in the book was to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I got this idea that I need to move to California. And at 9 o'clock, I was in my car and gone. Just trying to turn my back on everything. That was, you know, one of the gifts of step zero. And just for the record, if anybody's wondering, California doesn't work either. And should be on the Welcome to California sign. The state doesn't work. And but I was out there for about 4 or 5 months before I turned around and came home. And you know, faced all the music as far as, you know, the just Repo Man, the bankruptcy and the divorce and all that other good stuff, and the only thing I had left, you know, what I thought was my freedom, was basically emptiness. And I picked up a nice little promiscuity habit. I kept it out of Alcoholics Anonymous for the most part. Which did not perfectly, but for the most part. And if you have a sex addiction and you really want to get the job done, my advice to you is move to Boston, Massachusetts. Boston, Massachusetts has about 60-something universities. It's basically a city of hormones. And you can really get the job done regardless of what you're into in Boston. You guys can wait for the meeting to end before you leave. But anyways, so I did that, and I knew my behavior was irresponsible and reckless, so I was very, very protective. But every once in a while, I would take some risks, and I took one risk too many. I ended up with a virus that there was no cure for. And this was in 1995, June. I was 6 years sober, going to meetings, not drinking. And I hit my knees, and I told God that I was done with them. I had a brief moment of clarity where I was like, well, if I'm done with you, if I'm done with God, who am I down here on my knees talking to? Followed by right back into my self-pity. And I ran home to Mom. I moved back down to Maryland. My mom lived. And drained her of every emotion and dollar bill I could, not because I wanted to, but because I knew I didn't know any other way to live. And And if that wasn't bad enough, I still couldn't stop the behavior, and so now I'm infectious, and I'm hurting other people, and I can't stop. And I'm going to the doctors, and I'm asking them to lock me up, because I'm too afraid to commit suicide, because I'm afraid that whatever's next is going to be worse. And I have doctors tell me that I'm going to die, and my initial reaction is how do I look concerned? Because death looks like relief. The long, drawn-out transition might get my attention, but death in and of itself sounds like a good deal, you know? But I know that I can't say that. And that's the best I can do, managing my own life, just not drinking and going to meetings at 7 years sober. And I wish that I had alcohol to blame that on. I wish I could tell you that my problem was drinking. But I couldn't, because I hadn't had a drink in 7 years. And so that was the condition that I met my sponsor in. My sponsor is this crazy old gray hair guy with a red face, and kind of jiggles when he laughs, and he sparkles in his eyes when he looks at you. And he reminded me of Kris Kringle on Miracle on 34th Street. That was the first thing I thought of when I saw him. And he was talking about his recovery and his AA, and he was talking about it with a genuine certainty and a genuine joy. And I had never seen anybody who I believed and trusted the way I did him. I hated all his followers, but I loved him, and I still love him. I came this close to walking out the door at that meeting because my head was screaming at me. Anybody ever had their head scream at them? My head was screaming at me, saying, when he finds out who you are and what you've been doing, he is going to tell you, get out of here, get out of Alcoholics Anonymous, stay away from me, stay away from my dog. I'm not into animals. That was a joke. Anyways, I do love dogs, not that way though. But anyway, for whatever reason, I said, "Well, what do I got to lose?" So I went over to him and I looked him right in the shoelaces, and I said, "Tom, I've been coming around this dog and pony show for about 7 years, and I don't have a clue what you're talking about." And he asked me if I could meet him the following night. Now, the following night was a Tuesday night. And even though I'm dying, I'm going to the Naval War College on Tuesday nights to get one more degree from my I Love Me Wall. And I'm like, I can't go tomorrow because I got school. Right? And he's like, okay, well, I guess your school is more important than your recovery. I thought that was kind of a weird response. He asked me if I could meet him on Wednesday. I did. And I met him on Wednesday, and he sat me down, and he said things to me along the lines of, Steve, you don't have a drinking problem. What you got is a real bad case of sobriety. I said, you got that right. And he started telling me about alcoholism and spirituality and about the one alcoholic sharing with another, and a little bit about the history of one alcoholic sharing with another. He talked about the Washingtonians. He talked about the Oxford groups. He talked about AA. And he talked about the wisdom of the ages. He said that this is not about Alcoholics Anonymous, that this is about the wisdom of the ages and about principles. And I heard him, you know, enough to where I came back the next night. And I brought a friend. My buddy would sit, and he'd sit in the back seat, and Tom would say something, and I would say something, and Tom would say something, and I would say something, and Tom would say, Steve, sit down, shut up, we don't want what you have. And I'm like, I don't know who this guy thinks he's talking to. I'm Steve Farnsworth. 7 years sober. You know? But I shut up, and I looked at him, and he goes, you don't even want what you have. Like, oh, yeah. Forgot about that. So anyways, So I watched him like a hawk. And I would go to the meetings, and I would watch. And I've always been a people watcher my whole life. And while everybody else was joking and smoking with their friends, he'd be sitting over there in the corner with a new guy or sometimes a new girl. And I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I could tell the body language. And I knew something magical was going on in that one alcoholic sharing with another. And I am here to report to you that in that moment in time, I wanted what my sponsor had more than I wanted anything in this world. It was the only thing in the world that I wanted, because I had already tried everything else. So, you know, to the best of my ability, I wanted that. I wanted to be able to experience that magic. And we started going through the steps a little bit. And it was a little difficult. I was living half my time in Boston and half my time in Baltimore. But we managed. And the first time I went up to a guy, I went up to this guy, Gary, at the coffee pot. And I told him, and it said something along the lines of, Gary, that greater guy over there in the corner is talking to that lady, but he's really watching me. And he wants me to try to help somebody, and I don't know how to do that. So do you think you can kind of make it look like I'm trying to help you? Because he dropped that line on me, my sponsor did. He says, you need to go help somebody. And I said, I'm not qualified. And he says, I know you're not qualified, and you know you're not qualified, but that new guy doesn't know you're not qualified. Get over there and help him. So I was like, how do you argue with a guy like that, right? So anyway, so that's pretty much how I started on this journey of trying to be my brother's keeper as my daily bread. It's not the only thing I do, but it is just as essential and vital to me as my next meal and my next drink of water and my next breath of air and me getting shelter from the elements and getting a good night's sleep. If I don't exercise my spiritual condition by sharing my experience with my brother or my sister one-on-one, then you will see a totally different man appear before you. And that I can promise you. I can assure you. It is that vital. I tend to be a little excessive when I find something that I like. I know I'm the only one in here that does that. And I started feeling the power, not my power, but the power in my heart that was so difficult, if not impossible, to try to describe. The best definition I could come up with to try to explain it to you is if you can envision a target with rings around it. And we're all coming at it from a different place to that bullseye. But when I hit that bullseye, I know I feel it. I can't deny it. And it feels right. It's like when everything is just right, and I don't want to be anywhere except right here, right now, with you. And it's perfect, you know? And when I'm not feeling it, the form that it'll take will be many and varied away from that bullseye, you know? And a bunch of different people are coming from different places, different experiences, different geographic places, different degrees of desperation and willingness. You know, so, you know, my specific path probably won't work for you unless you're somewhere similar to the place where I am. You know, so I'm not trying to say that my path is the path that you have to take. I don't have a right path. If I just have my experience, you know. But we get to that bullseye, and I know I'm there when I'm there. I can't describe it well, or you know, accurately. But I can't deny it. The closest thing I can come to it is holding a baby in my arms. When I hold a baby in my arms, I know something instinctively happens to me. It fills my heart. I can't put words accurately to describe it, but I can't deny that I'm feeling it. And coincidentally, the first century Christians took the word sin from the sport of archery, which means to miss the mark. You know the primary weapon to for man to defend himself back then, it was the bow and arrow. So it makes, that's no surprise, right? So it makes sense to me. Whether I'm delusional or not, I don't know. But I'm telling you, it makes sense to me, and it's made sense to me for a long time. I had a serious distaste in my heart for organized religion back then. I don't have that today. I'm able to actually sit down and look and read, you know, things from other types of spiritual endeavors, including different religions, and feel what they're saying, rather than have to intellectually try to examine it and analyze it and understand it and feel it. And you know that little fish that a lot of Christians throw in the back of their cars? You know, it comes from a passage in the Bible that talks about you can give a man a fish and feed him for a day, or you can teach him how to fish and feed him for a lifetime. Come with me, I'll make you a fisher of men. The translation for Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion, is I can take you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and give you relief for a second. Or I can show you how to take other people through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and feed you for a lifetime. Come with me, I will show you how to find other people to take through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you can be free without having to worry about what these other people do with what you share with them. My sponsor told me a long time ago, he said, we are in the making it available business, Steve. We are not in the results business. You are not concerned with whether or not these people comply with your suggestions. You're concerned with how much are you making it available, and are you making it available with your heart, not with your head. Remember, your head screaming at you. Remember, your head is committee meetings and don't let you get a word in. You don't want to use that thing for anything. You know, use your heart. You can't mistake the language of the heart. You know when somebody really, really, truly wants to help you. You know, even the sickest alcoholic knows that when I sit down and give him my time, that he may not believe a word that I have to say. He probably, for all I know, I sound like Charlie Brown's teacher to him. You know, he can't even hear it. But he knows that I care enough about him to give him my time. And the thing about giving somebody else your time is, you know, I can go out and make more money, but I can't make more time. And once I've spent it, I spent it. It's gone. It's spent. And I spent it on you, my brother, or my sister, to let you know that I don't have an answer, but I do know how to get tapped into a power that does. And it's based on principle and the wisdom of the ages. You know, Emmett Fox said that we reap what we sow. He said this is a concise and powerful statement, that we literally reap what we sow. You know, I envision the farmer who's planting seeds of wheat. Okay, he doesn't know which seeds are going to take root, but he knows that if he plants enough of them, he's going to get a whole lot more back than how many he planted. He doesn't know if some of those seeds that he planted are going to take root this season, next season, or 5 or 6 seasons down the road. But he knows that he's going to get back a whole bunch of wheat, and he's going to get back some a few seasons down the road too. And the other thing he knows is he's not going to get back corn, because he didn't plant corn. Right? That's what we do when we go out planting seeds of love. Telling my brother and my sister, hand out my life, telling them the good news and where the power is. And I know that I'm going to get back thousands of forms of love. I don't know which ones are going to come back. I don't know if they're going to come back this season, next season, or 5, 6 seasons down the road, but I'm going to get back. But Emmett Fox said, he said, God, in his infinite wisdom, that means beyond human intellectual comprehension, his infinite wisdom created the laws of the universe. And then, this is the part that most people have a problem with, and then he got out of the way to let them work themselves out. He's not interfering with every transaction. God is not a high-priced bellboy. Go get me this, go get me that. Because if he was interfering with every transaction, there would be no law, no principle, nothing that you and I could depend upon. And this world would be in complete chaos. The problem with most humans, in my opinion, is because we want to intellectually understand things, you know, is these laws of the universe, as precise as they are, they're too big for the human mind to comprehend. So, but the closest I can get to it is by comparables, you know, it's kind of like this. It's like the kingdom of heaven. It's like this. It's like the farmer planting seeds, you know, and all these different ways of coming out trying to describe that bullseye, what I'm feeling, and what I'm not feeling. It, the form that it'll take, it will be hundreds of forms. One thing that they'll all have in common: fear, and me thinking about me. You know, all fear has purpose. It's designed to cause me to change my direction, to go back to that bullseye. I have an absolutely beautiful life. I've had everything, and I continue to have everything in my life that I've ever wanted, you know, a lot more. I'll tell you this last story, because I think I'm running out of time. I'm probably over time for all I know, for instance. But my sponsor knows me pretty well. And, you know, I was raised, you know, in the same society, you know, that everybody here probably was. And, you know, I was given the male version of that Cinderella fairy tale, you know, where one day you'll grow up and you'll have a little family and, you know, you want to have kids and stuff. And that's the one thing that used to bring sadness to my heart, is that I, you know, due to a set of circumstances beyond my control, that I'll probably never be able to have my own children. And that really brought me a lot of sadness, and it was on my doorstep, but I didn't really say it much other than that, because I knew there's nothing I could do about it. Nothing, you know, whining and crying about it's not going to change anything. And one time I was at this meeting in Virginia. They had two 30-minute speakers, and both of them were talking about how beautiful their lives were and how they had, you know, they got sober and they came to AA, and God put this beautiful girl in my life, and I have these absolutely beautiful kids that I wake up to every morning, and da 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 da, and I'm like, that's great for you. I'm gonna go stick a fork in my eye. So I took off and I went for a little walk, and my sponsor saw me. He came up and he walked alongside me, and he said, Steve, you know, there's man's world and there's God's world. And in God's world, there's a lot of different kind of parents. All these kids, all these young men and women that look to you for guidance and direction, you know, they may or may not have loving parents, but one thing they didn't have is parents that were able to give them what they needed on the spiritual plane. And you've been able to do that. And not only that, you get thousands of kids, you know, that look at you in that way. And maybe God just needed a different kind of parent with you. And that may sound ridiculous to you, but it fit right in my heart. And just like somebody turned off a light switch, I've never been sad about that since. I've actually been really, really grateful. Because if I did force, you know, some woman to marry me, you know, through manipulation and whatever, and have children with her, which I've seen people do, you know, not only would I have hurt her and probably those kids, but I would have missed this. And I'm so grateful that I haven't missed this. And I'll tell you a beautiful little story about a young man that I sponsor in Delaware who struggled for years. I couldn't love a kid. He's a young man, but he's a kid to me. You know, more because he's my own flesh and blood. And I had so many people tell me to let him go. And it was, you know, I mean, it eventually had to. And it was the only time, that was when he got well, by the way, too, in my life. But a couple months ago, he came up to me and he said, my girlfriend's pregnant. And I was like, okay, how do you feel about that? And he's like, I'm all right with it. And he said, I'm really, really afraid. And I said, what are you afraid of? Because, you know, in my mind, I'm like, it's the most natural thing in the world, right? And he said, I'm really afraid that he's going to be just like me. And with all the confidence and certainty that I have in my heart and in my DNA, I told him, and I meant it, and I still mean it, that if that kid comes out to be just like you, this world's going to be a much better place. And I meant that. I have got some of the most incredible kids in my life. My life is full. It's been full for a long time. And it's had a lot of promise to stay full. And I know that I'm a winner. I'll be crying like a little baby. However, I'm telling you, I love my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you. I love God. And I am really, really having a good time. And I really hope you are too. If you're not, please let us know. Because it's your birthright. Life is not meant to be endured. It's meant to be enjoyed. We found a way to enjoy it. So please join us. Thank you very much.